Welcome to Kinfolk Lore. Today we're here to discuss episode 6 of one of our favorite costume dramas, The Gilded Age. We're excited to track all of the going-ons between Team New Money and Team Old Money as they fight for power in New York's high society at the end of the 19th century. I'm Andrea.
And I'm Paul, and I'm on strike. 8-8-8!
Oh, man. This is not your 8 hours of rest.
This is
your
not.
8 hours of work.
8 hours of work. 8 hours of rest. 8 hours to emotionally prepare for work again. Oh, man. And for those of you joining us for the first time, we are cousins who love to explore fantasy and sci-fi stories. Last year, we expanded our coverage to discuss our favorite period pieces. We kicked off that coverage with discussing the Gilded Age, and so we're back to discuss Julian Fellowes' newest project with more in-depth analysis. You can find all our episodes on Downton Abbey, Bridgerton, Outlander, and The Crown in your podcast feeds.
We're very excited to spend each week catching up with the Russells, Van Ryan clan, and all of the many rich characters in this costume drama. This week, Bertha Russell scores a win over Mrs. Astor and Turner. Aunt Ada receives some devastating news, and Marianne gets reluctantly engaged.
And you know what, Andrea? The only thing we both know for certain is that without adult content, our listeners will be hurt. Thank goodness that Jack's clock is not the only thing setting off alarm bells in this episode. We got the pop-up store proposal. And Aunt Ada is worked the rector's back out in Niagara Falls. I mean, crossing the threshold? Air quotes? I mean, was that really crossing the threshold that happened? Or was it like, you know?
I did a double take when they were like, she was like, I didn't help matters. I was like, what? What?
Oh my God.
What are we talking about right now, Ada?
Oh, it was so good. She reeled it back to be a little PG for Agnes's sake. I'm sorry. It was not crossing the threshold that happened, but it's all right.
Wait, absolutely not.
Oh.
All right. So let's catch up with Team New Money. The much foreshadowed strike. It only took us 6 episodes
so
to get to the actual strike.
So many episodes.
Is finally upon us. George Russell heads to Pittsburgh to try to reason with Mr. Henderson. If the strike goes forward, there will be violence. Henderson understands this, but he refuses to budge. When it comes down to it, George is the one who blinks, refusing to allow the National Guard to fire on his workers. Meanwhile, you know, in much lower stakes situations, Turner insists that she and Mr. Winterton should have the central box at the Met when it opens, because they're bringing several of their old money friends with them. Bertha agrees, but then later George tells Mr. Gilbert it is not going down that way.
Mm-mm. Mm-mm. No, he sends him a very politely makes him take a whole train ride on timeout before he takes him 2.5 hours by a modern train ride. Okay, I just went, for all you people who are not New Yorkers, Middletown is 2.5 hours away from New York City on the way to Philadelphia. It's kind of crazy. On the way to Pennsylvania. Sorry, on the way to Pennsylvania. It's kind of crazy. So nuts.
I have so many, knowing this area as I do, because I used to live on the other side of Middletown in Jersey, I'm like, this is way out there. Like,
way out.
Most definitely not the most direct route to Pittsburgh. But anyway, Mr. Church is seen coming home smashed. He's drunk.
Yeah.
He got lit.
Yeah.
Went out.
Fell over, like, drunk. Yeah, he's
and
drunk.
Bannister seizes this opportunity to get justice.
Bannister. Oh, my God.
For Church's snitching on him in the past, he writes a letter to Mr. Russell to tell him about Church's behavior, but retrieves it when he finds out that the other butler was drinking for a very understandable reason.
Mm-hmm.
Bertha learns that the Duke will be her guest on opening night of the opera. And she could not be more gleeful.
100%. Yo, listen, Gladys takes the words out of everybody's mouth. Here, I don't understand. Are you and Mrs. Astor friends or enemies? And Bertha's wild. The two are not mutually exclusive. Like, what?
I mean, she's not wrong. Like, she says friends or rivals. And I was like, there's a lot of female friendships like this.
Yeah.
They're frenemies. They're frenemies.
For sure. For sure. So let's talk about what's happening with Team Old Money. Oscar gets in deeper with the investment that Ma Beaton's business manager introduced him to last episode. I mean, in deep. Like, could have just walked away with his money, decides to double down, and also show up with an additional check. This guy really wants in. That what he saw must have been really great. Even though they offered to buy him out, he insists on committing a large sum and becoming a principal investor. So things are also heating up with Maude herself as at the garden pop-up show. They share their first kiss. Dashiell has planned a party to celebrate his family getting a plaque at the Botanical Gardens. Okay. Initially, Marion can't attend because she's like, I'm teaching. I have a teaching commitment, of which he's, you know, kind of has a wild take we'll get to. And the headmistress shows up while she's barely there and was like, yo, I want you to go into this party. Shouldn't she be going to Mr. Dashiell's party? And I don't know how this, I have a lot of questions to how the headmistress is so invested in her going to the party unless somebody manipulated this, but that's a whole different story. So Marion leaves, goes to the party. She's barely there for a few minutes when Dashiell arrives and proposes in front of everyone and announces that's why he invited all of her friends who didn't have any real connection to this plaque he was getting or the Botanical Gardens, but they show up to see the proposal. Marion reluctantly accepts, and reluctantly is being kind. It was awkward. Jack has finally figured out how to make an alarm clock work. Amazing. Yay, Jack. He's like the most wholesome person in the show. I love him. He gets investments from the entire Van Ryn household except Armstrong. Fucking Armstrong.
I just can't stand this woman. Yo. I don't. She's just the worst. Anyway, not because she didn't give him the money. No one's obligated to invest in anyone. But just because she's been so down on like everything, she's just like the worst kind of Debbie Downer.
It's all of her takes around it. It's like, when everybody's giving money, she says, I'm not giving my money to moonshine. I'm like, yo, come on, get out of here. Anyway, the patent that he puts in is rejected because he's not a member of the clockmaking society. Peggy returns home, and it's a bit rocky. After she tells her parents that and Marion about her experience in the South, who both are concerned about her, she tells Marion more about the kiss. She tells her parents more about what happened in the barn. While outraged about the danger she put herself in for work, Dorothy Scott sees an opportunity now to get Mr. Fortune's newspaper to cover the challenges of Black people in New York City and what's happening in the schools. So it's a connection to the actual story in some way because it's about education up north. Her mom draws that connection as this could be a good follow-up piece, and she follows up. It's really great. Over the course of the episode, Ada's joy crumbles. Just last episode, we saw her get married, and now Mr. Forte has been diagnosed with cancer and appears to be terminally ill. Agnes goes to comfort her sister right away, but the newlyweds decide to face the tragic news on their own in their own home. I have thoughts about this cancer, or as I like to call it, mysterious movie disease.
I really hate this plotline. I'm just going to put that out there. I will talk more next week about why I hate it, but I really just don't like it. I really can't with this one.
Yeah. It feels very rushed is what the main thing is. It's like in the beginning of the episode, he has a backache. After coming back, I mean, they were just all the way in Niagara Falls, which also I had some weird thing. I was like, man, how much time is elapsing? That Niagara Falls by horse and buggy is, I guess they could have gone by train. They could have went by train. Okay, I was thinking to myself, I'm like, they went to Niagara Falls. How did they get there so fast and get back so fast? But could have went by train. But yeah, it just feels like a lot of time is moving and fast. And then this, by beginning of the episode, he's totally fine. End of the episode, he's bedridden.
Anyway, I have big problems with this plot. When we were watching this together, I had big problems then. They have not gotten better on subsequent rewatches. I have a lot of issues with this plot line.
Yeah, yeah. And so what do we know about Julian Fellowes and his writing and when he does this? Because we've seen this happen. This is not the first time that he's introduced this, if you're a Downton watcher.
With the exception of Matthew and Sybil's deaths, which were both because the actors were leaving, anytime he introduces a character death, it benefits another character. And so I just, like, I guess my thing was this. I would be fine if he had introduced Mr. Forte only so that he could die at the beginning of next season. I just have a problem with the speed of which all this has happened.
Yeah.
So I don't like that Mr. Forte shows up in episode 1 and is terminally ill by episode 6. I just, in between that, he allegedly courted and fell in love with and married Ada, who is one of our favorite characters. Like, I remember when we were talking about the show last year, we were very much wanted Ada to have more story.
Mm-hmm.
And this is great. That part, like, watching her, like, defy her sister, watching her grow more independent, watching the relationship between her and Marion has been wonderful. But I really just don't understand why we have to have a terminal illness already. It just feels way, 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 way too rushed. And then they have this larger problem, which I think is like a problem with period pieces that are based in our real world,
mm-hmm.
is that the actual time, I think I mentioned this last week as well, but like the actual timeline is so compressed because we know it's 1883, but we also know that the Brooklyn Bridge isn't open yet. The Brooklyn Bridge opened in May of 1883. This show started on Easter, which was 6 weeks previously.
Yeah.
So all of this is supposed to have happened in like 6 weeks. I don't think that's true. I think the story that Julian Fellowes is actually telling us is that the Brooklyn Bridge is going to open sometime in the fall, right? Because this is episode 6. The opera hasn't opened yet, but it's coming quickly. We know the opera opens in October. So I'm assuming that the Brooklyn Bridge opening will be sometime around that. But it's like, why did they? This is so frustrating to me because I don't know. We're not rooted in any real time or space because they've moved around real events to make it work for the plot. But also, just by the nature of a show of this many characters, nothing gets enough time. So everything feels like it's going really quickly, except for one thing. The stupid opera fight. Like, that's been going.
The opera
like it's going on forever.
The opera feels like they've put the opera and it feels like they put it to the side and they finally put in the forefront the strike, because the strike has also been going on forever, like you said in the opening. It's so crazy. It's like, I feel you. I feel everything you're saying. It feels like this episode was so jam-packed with everything. It's like they decided, okay, we have to start moving these stories to the threshold, right? So we got to get Marion to be engaged. We got to set up something for Peggy to do in New York City that's related to what just happened in the South. We got to get this thing happening with Luke to become ill. We got to give Agnes a reason to like redeem herself for how she behaved before. It's like everybody has so much to do. And I remember when you were done going through and figured out, hey, let's talk about the whole how we're going to cover this. You were like, there is so much that happens in episode 6. And man, I watching it again, I was like, wow, this is crazy how much they've done. You know what I mean?
Yeah, in this episode? This episode has a lot of issues with pacing for me, but it also is, it's okay. I just want to say, this is a good episode.
It is.
I enjoyed it.
Me too.
I think it's great.
Me too.
I guess I'm wondering why we didn't get this before. I would have much rather had episodes paced like this than have a whole plot that hinges on, you know, a dinner, a whole plot that is about Mrs. Blaine and Larry. Like, I guess those are maybe setting up something in the future, but I just didn't have time for this. Like, I was like, why weren't we getting some of this stuff before? Like, I'm a little bit frustrated because this episode's so jam-packed, and it just doesn't feel like anything has time to breathe.
And he's so good at one thing that he doesn't use in this case he's good at introducing something that goes away and you totally forget about, and then it comes back later and you're like, oh my God, I should have caught that. So I don't understand why Mr. Forte's back isn't hurting like in an earlier episode, episode 2, episode 3, when he's getting up from lunch. Maybe it did and they had to cut it. Something would have been like a hint of like, oh, he has something going on with his back. And then if you introduce it, it's not just a back later on, it's like cancer. It had more time to breathe. So that would have fixed it. But, you know, listen, I like you said, I like the episode. It's just giving us Lavinia Squire vibes.
It is definitely giving me Lavinia Squire vibes. I was just like, so is this character Lavinia? Like, I don't.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very frustrating.
Yeah.
I mean, I like Mr. Forte. I never liked Lavinia. I I have a completely irrational dislike of Lavinia Squire. I understand that there's nothing wrong with her as a person. I just didn't have time for her. I was like, come on. We know Matthew and Mary are getting together. I don't have time for this lady.
Yeah. No, it was it was a massive detour. And we're sorry. If you have not watched Downton Abbey, we're just gonna give you this disclaimer. We're gonna talk a lot about Downton Abbey. And you know what? It's been out for a long time. So like you'll still enjoy it. Even if you hear what we're saying, you will still enjoy a watch if it's your first time.
I'm sorry. I'm not going to apologize for spoiling a show that's had enough time to go off air.
Have
multiple movies. Like, Downton, if you weren't going to watch, if you haven't watched Downton yet and you've avoided spoilers in the wild, which I don't know how you could, because when we were watching the show, there were spoilers on the internet.
Yeah.
But, like, I just, you've had years. It's been on every streaming service. I'm sorry if you haven't seen it. You should see it. It's a great show. We are talking about something that happens in season 2. It has there's certain things that you can, if you watch Downton, you can feel them happening again on The Gilded Age. These shows have very different tones. Yeah. And so I don't think that they're that similar. Of course, Julian Fellowes wrote all of Downton Abbey on his own. He intentionally brought in another writer, Sonia Warfield, mm-hmm. for The Gilded Age, in part because he wanted to tell a story that went beyond the aristocracy. So, you know, they're different shows, but you should still watch it.
Listen, you're great. I'm great. Niagara Falls is great. Agnes had a lot of good one-liners. She was definitely, for the most part, her better self. I wouldn't say her best self. There were some things in there, like she's the comments about people who are living in poverty. Rough stuff, okay. But like she was at least she showed up for her sister.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, at least she showed up for her sister. At least she showed up for her sister. So you want to talk about showing up? Speaking of showing up, and all of a sudden you know things being turned on its head. Poor Marion. She just shows up. Got off of work, thinking she's just coming to a little garden party. You know, drinks are out, people are chilling. What the hell happened here?
This is, like, actually my nightmare. Like, this is, I've had dreams about this. Like, what are you doing, Dashiell? It's such a lack of understanding who Marion is as a person.
Yeah.
She's not the type of woman who would have wanted a flashy proposal.
Yeah.
I have a really hard time of not feeling like this is manipulative. Like, he knows that he has a better chance of a yes.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, I don't know why you would do something like this. You don't know the Russells. So why are you inviting them to witness this? Oh, because they're Marion's friends. She wouldn't want this. Like, It's very frustrating. On Ada's face through this whole thing it says everything. Like, Ada is appalled.
Yeah, agreed.
Appalled and concerned, and like understands that her niece is not at all interested in this. Like, she just doesn't want it. You know, Larry also is in his...
Well, he's in his feels. He's in his feels for a different reason. He's a little tight. Yo, my guy is tight. Listen, study long, study wrong, Larry Russell. Okay? You're out there in freaking Newport acting all whatever. Like, listen, you needed to, like, get it together sooner. And that's why Dashiell invited him. Sorry.
I was crying because I was like, Larry, you have no standing here. Like, none.
At all.
Like, not even a little bit. Like, you spent the whole summer messing around in Newport when you could have been here wooing your next door neighbor.
Yeah.
And now you're salty because you didn't move fast enough? Nah, bro.
And then he tries to like get in there and like talk to her about it at the worst possible moment. He's all like, oh man, this is terrible when you should be celebrating. And Marion's like, what are you talking about? Celebrating? And he's like, yeah, your engagement. And she's like, oh, that's the furthest thing from my mind. He's like, well, if you need any help, if you need any help with anything, I'm like, Larry, this is crazy, bro. you're crazy right now. Oh, this is nuts.
It was this whole thing. This whole party was bizarre. I do want to say that going back to Agnes's one-liners. Why not teach some the next day? They'll still be poor and needy.
I promise you. Come on. I don't know. Between that and what you would call and what's her name? The daughter. What's the daughter's name again?
Frances.
Yeah. Between that and Frances talking about...
I'm sure the poor people won't mind.
Yeah, exactly.
These people, I really... Oh, like, the notion that like, you can just reschedule... Okay. Let me calm down a little bit. But it's like the notion that these people, because they're poor, aren't the most tightly scheduled people on this whole show. Y'all literally walk around all day having garden parties, yes, writing letters.
Yes.
These people have to work.
Exactly. This is what
you cannot just be like, no, come tomorrow. No, they have to go to work tomorrow.
Yeah. It's kind of crazy. It's super crazy. But you see how freaking like disconnected they are. Even when Dashiell's like, you're not a real teacher, like, you know what I mean, like when he says that to Marion, it's like they're disconnected to working class people, you know what I mean, like Marion is doing something that like it's foreign to them, you know what I mean, they can't totally wrap their minds around it.
And I found Dashiell's you're not a real teacher to be both disrespectful to Marion and disrespectful to his own daughter.
Agreed.
Where she teaches. Yep. As if what she's teaching his daughter has no meaning.
Yeah.
Like, why teach young women art, right? And then disrespectful to poor people. Like, it's everything about this. I was, while the one-liners from Agnes were hysterical, they were, this made the Van Ryans look like monsters.
Yeah.
The Russells would never.
Never.
Like, you could not imagine that any of the Russells saying any of this.
No, they would just like, you know, like almost get into a gunfight with their workers. But other than that, they, I'm joking. No, you're right. You're right. 100%. Even the thing I thought about is the difference in what you're saying is the stark difference between how Mrs. Russell treated Henderson,
mm-hmm,
versus how they would have treated Henderson. Yeah, for sure.
Going back to the Henderson Mrs. Russell meeting, the deep respect that Mrs. Russell showed for the fact that they have six children,
yep,
and that his wife still works.
Yep.
I admire her and I believed her. She wasn't, mm-hmm, just saying that to be like to ingratiate herself. I believe her. So she like sees, mm-hmm, that working class people actually have to work.
Yeah, agreed. 100% agree. 100% agree. Yeah, Dashiell, I just want to go on the record. You know, I'm not going to call myself out too much because I don't want to go on a bad run, but I am on a good run here. We have Lord Asriel, Boreal, Mr. Rakes, and now Dashiell. Dashiell is not in the same vein as these, but I have found every season I'm like, no, I'm out on that guy pretty early. And I'm glad I was out on him. I'm out on this comment.
I I still like Dashiell. Here's the thing. It's hard for me to disconnect the time period from what he's saying, right?
Yeah.
What he's saying, I could very well see Lord Grantham saying on Downton Abbey, which was 40 years after this. Mm-hmm. Because he did say similar things to Edith when she was, you know, wanted to write for a newspaper. Mm-hmm. Lord Grantham is a good person. We know that from the show. I think Dashiell is a good person. He just has views that don't align with Marianne. Sorry, don't align with Marianne. And I think that we're supposed to see that contrast between him and Larry, who last episode was proud of Mrs. Roebling, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I think that, you know, Dashiell's like a standard misogynist, nothing out of the usual.
Just your standard issue. Standard issue, like, you know, Gilded Age misogynist. Yeah, I get it. I get it. I also thought that it's not a good look for him if you're like trying to like woo and you plan on proposing. Like, maybe you don't have like a life-size photo or painting of your deceased wife in the middle of your living room.
I don't have a problem with that.
Really? Like, it does not scream, I've moved on. Like, I'm about to propose to you.
But I think his wife only died a few years ago, and that's still his daughter's mother. I don't have a problem with it.
Yeah, okay.
I don't have an issue with it. Yeah. I think, as someone who knows a couple of widows and widowers who are fairly recent widows and widowers, grieving takes a long time, and it comes and goes. And even when you remarry, that love that you felt for that other person is still there. And I don't have a problem with him honoring his wife with a place of honor in the household. You know, like, I don't have an issue with it. Maybe Marion will feel differently when she moves in, but I don't have a problem with it right now.
Yeah, I don't have a problem with him honoring his dead wife. What I'm saying is, it's the positioning of it, and where it is and how centered, it's like if you're the next day about to propose and you're inviting the person you're about to propose into the house, maybe there has to be some room for that person too.
Sure. I still don't have an issue with this. Like, I don't think I would have a problem with this it would be different if they were divorced, but if it were someone that I was interested in and they were still grieving and they had that in their living room, I wouldn't have any issue with it. This is still part of them. It's part of their family.
But aren't they trying? Do you think that they're trying to tell us something though with that? Like having that where she notices it, because he doesn't do anything by accident. Where she walks in and notices it. What do you think he's trying to communicate with that? Like, fellows, I'm talking about.
I think he's trying to communicate that that Dashiell's not over his wife. But yeah. I don't have an issue with that. I think that's fine. Like, the way she's still his family, it would be like, it's like, okay, so over in the Scott household, they have a mantle where they keep pictures of their dad. And I think that this largely falls the same way. Like, she's still part of the family.
Yeah, sure. I don't.
And Dashiell, it did actually bother me when Dashiell said, at the garden party, my family is not complete.
Yeah,
that actually bothered me more than this picture, because I have a lot of issues with the fact that he's saying that his family can't be complete unless he has someone to take care of his kid.
Yeah,
but more importantly, what is it, like, if I were Francis, I would be like, what do you mean it's not complete?
Yeah, that's wild too. Yeah, 100%. 100%.
So, I didn't have any issue with this. I think you're right that Fellows is trying to show us that he hasn't moved on, but I still don't have an issue with it if he hasn't moved on. I guess I've read enough classic novels to know that, like, marriage is not usually romantic a business, a social standing thing for both women and men. Mm-hmm. And so I wouldn't, like, is Marion really looking for a love match here? I don't even know that she is. I don't think she is.
Yeah, I don't think she is. You know.
So like Dashiell, accepting Dashiell, even though it made her uneasy, is not crazy. Like it is, most young women in her situation would accept him. And this is something I just learned. I thought, how old would you say Marion? Why do I keep doing? I'm sorry. I have two friends and a coworker named Marianne. So this is, her name is like a real struggle for me. Well, how old would you say Marianne is?
24, 23.
So I thought she was about 21, 22. She's 25.
Huh.
Okay. Her and Peggy are both in their mid to late 20s. She's like verging on being an old maid, which is why Agnes is so eager to get her married, because the way Agnes is looking at it is like time is running out. Like you need to make a match soon or you're going to be left on the shelf. And so I don't think it was nuts for her to accept him. I don't think it, even if he hasn't gotten over his wife, I think it is what it is. That's not the life we want for her. But I think in the time period, that would be really standard.
Yeah. I mean, I just feel like I get it. That's where I was coming from. It's like it's one thing if she had also lived somewhat of a life, but I don't feel like she really has. And like, I feel like she would be coming into this life where he's had a whole life, kid, blah, blah, blah. And it'd be different if he was talking to somebody that is, or dating someone or interested in someone, courting someone who was like, I don't know, Mrs. Blaine. No, I'm joking. I'm playing. But I keep saying that. But I'm just saying, like, someone who's already had like a marriage or, you know, some form of life. I feel like Marion's like got all this like, I'm not sure I want to do this career thing. I don't want everything to fall in this bucket. Like, there's a lot that she still has in front of her that I don't know. It just feels weird. Their whole dynamic.
Yeah, they're not a good match. Like, in terms of interest. And first of all, these people don't know each other. They've spent 5 minutes. They went to a play where he left early.
Yeah.
And, you know, they walked around a casino together. Like, they're not. This is not like, you know, like she doesn't even know him as well as she knows as Aurora, right? Yeah, she certainly doesn't know him as well as she knows Oscar. So this is not, I don't think they're well suited. I agree with you that he would be much better with someone who was actually interested in playing mom.
Yeah.
Francis, like someone who has a real interest in that, who isn't just marrying him for the safety of it. And because she likes Francis, or to please other people, like I totally agree that they're not well suited. I just still I don't think it's a bad match. I just think they're not well suited.
Yeah. I mean, just Larry's a stand in for me right now in this freaking show. I'm sitting here like, no, no, that face that Larry had that looked like his mom mixed with his dad when like they don't get what they want. I was like, yeah, I'm with you, Larry. He like walked away. He was hot. He was irritated at that garden party.
Wow. I think it's so funny that so many of the fans are shipping Larry and Marion, and they haven't really shown us that she has any attraction to him beyond friendship. And this was the first time I got a real glimmer from him that he had a real interest. I think he likes her, and I think he likes to flirt with her. I don't necessarily think that he was considering her seriously, because I don't think Larry takes much of anything seriously.
Yeah, it's true.
But I love that they have such great chemistry and such an ease together that the fans are already like, just make this happen. Why are we doing this?
Yeah, because I mean, it was like some of the scenes where like, I think it was, I mean, I was calling it like that I wanted it like early, but like I think it really solidified when, like, you know, end of last season, he walks her across the street. And then, like, her being so excited when she sees him come back from Newport this season. And I don't know. It's just like, it's a pipe dream. We never know. Look, she just said yes. So it could be, who knows where he's going with this plot line.
Well, the rate that people are being disposed of on this show, maybe Dashiell gets run over by a carriage next episode. Like, I don't know, but I the expression, there's such good acting in this show. Yeah. And there was recently an article about why they chose to work with stage actors, because a lot of the cast are predominantly stage actors. Mm-hmm. Even the ones who are well known are also known for Broadway.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, well known in Hollywood, they're also known for Broadway. And so the level of the garden party scene didn't actually have that many main characters in it, but those who were in it served a purpose for showing us like the range of emotion of witnessing this proposal. I gotta hand it, you know, Marianne's face when she realized what was happening, I was like, yes, your mother Meryl taught you.
Yes.
She looked so uneasy. She looked like she was going to vomit. And I think that a lot of women put in her position would feel a sense of dread, anxiety, like all these rushing emotions. And then there's just this, like, she doesn't know how to feel.
And who was right? behind?
Because at the end of the day, everyone's telling her Dashiell is a catch. And Dashiell is a catch. First of all, Dashiell's good looking.
Mm-hmm.
Let me not turn into Agnes, but...
That's what Agnes exactly... She was like, besides the fact of he's well-born, he's also attractive. He also is very nice. I was like, you know, Agnes, you don't give two shits about any of that. You are very happy with getting her off your payroll. You get out of here.
Yeah, no, she's rapidly trying to... Because, you know, look at... Marianne's out here wearing new dresses. She's like, listen, you gotta come off of the Van Ryan payroll.
Yeah. And you know who knew about this setup before she knew about this setup? Obviously. Aurora damn Fane. She's queen of the bad match. Queen of the bad match. Oh my gosh. Wild stuff from Aurora Fane all the time.
There was a question. Speaking of getting Marianne off of the Van Ryan expense account. There's a question about, I saw this question actually multiple times. I saw it on Reddit. I saw it on Facebook. People seem to be questioning like how wealthy are the Van Ryans? How wealthy are the Russells? How wealthy are the Fanes? My estimation based on what we have seen is that the Russells are billionaires in our, like, what would be considered a billionaire in our day and age.
Mm-hmm.
The Van Ryans are wealthy, but they're the type of generational wealth that dwindles with each generation.
Mm-hmm.
So rich. And then the Fanes are somewhere in between. I don't think that they are as well off as the Russells, but they're certainly not looking at dwindling expense like the Van Ryans. So the Van Ryans are still very wealthy. Like, I think all of this talk about, like, you know, like, wanting to Marianne to get married quickly, Oscar looking for a fortune hunter, I think people think that means that these folks are not going to be rich, like, in one generation. I don't think that's the truth. I think what's happening here is, like, many of old money families over time, if you don't do something to make more money, that money is finite. It doesn't.
Yeah, it's solidifying.
It doesn't multiply because you're not earning enough to keep up with your lifestyle. And I think that's why Oscar is so anxious to get some dividends here.
Yeah, yeah. He wants to be able to say, like, because it feels like a lot of the money, he has his career as a banker, but a lot of the money is really seems like it came from his dad. You know what I mean? Like, so he wants to make his own way. You know what I mean? Make his own, you know, mark. And I think, I agree totally with your assessment.
I think he wants to be heading towards Mr. Russell.
Yeah.
Exactly. Right?
Yeah.
And he's not. His funds are that he knows enough about the expenses and how things are looking. He can see that, like, at some point the Van Ryan family is going to just run out of money.
Yeah, agreed. Yeah, I like your assessment of, like, where everybody sits on the board. Speaking of Mr. Russell, He shows up to Pittsburgh looking like the Monopoly man.
Legit like the I was like, dude.
Yeah. He's like didn't dress for the occasion. He shows up like, I will pay you $300 for Baltic Ave. Do not pass go. Do not collect $200. Oh, man. And Mr. Clay, real piece of shit. Like legitimately ready to, like, he said he would stop Mr. Russell from going into Henderson's house if he could. And Mr. Russell's like, you don't have that power. And then he's, like, pissed off that Mr. Russell stops the government agents from shooting the strikers to get, like, scabs through. I mean, not my favorite dude.
I think the worst thing for me was when Russell was like, why are all the kids out and about? Like, is there even a school here? And Clay is like, I don't know and I don't care.
Yeah, terrible. Yeah,
like, terrible. You don't even see these workers as human. And I also think that even though Henderson told George how he lives and how his workers live, mm-hmm. I think that George was surprised.
Yeah,
at how bad things were. And also just like the modest way that Henderson, who is not management, but a leader, has three incomes in his household. They're living in this very, very, very modest way. And I think he's actually taken a little bit aback by that. I would love to know more about the Russells and how they grew up.
Yeah.
Because we know that Bertha comes from a family of farmers. Mm-hmm. But like, that doesn't necessarily mean poverty, right?
No.
You can have farmers who are middle class, you can have farmers who are wealthy, but I'd love to know more about how were they raised? Like, did they come up from the middle class? Did they come up from, you know, not wealth, but like fairly, you know, upper middle class, almost wealthy? Like, how did they get to where they are today?
Yeah. No, it'll be interesting. It'll be interesting to give us some flashbacks. You know, they haven't done that. That'd be interesting to, like, kind of see, like, you know, like in another season or episode, like young Bertha, young George. Oh, man. But this was intense, to be honest. It really does. To see him visit the Hendersons and to see the stark difference and to hear his wife say, you know, we can't offer you the same hospitality that you offer my husband, but, you know, would you take some coffee? And for, you know, again, the Russells, he does, he accepts the coffee, and he even goes and greets his wife, Mrs. Henderson when he's leaving, meets his son who works in the factory. So I do think he's a little surprised by how what's happening there. But I also think that doesn't mean take him off the hook. You know what I mean? Like, he knows enough now to say, hey, you know what? Maybe there is something about my policies that aren't great. You know what I mean? That I need to look at. So
yeah, he showed a demonstration of empathy that I wasn't really expecting from him, to be honest.
Yeah.
But like, he can, as yeah. much as he, as much as George and Bertha generally treat their servants with respect, although that sometimes they don't. I have a lot of mixed feelings about them.
Yeah.
He treats his workers like they're just cogs in a system. Like, he doesn't even, I think Henderson's probably the first one laborer he's ever known by name.
Yeah. Yeah. I would agree. I totally would agree. And that was really like the sign of the times. It's not until, I mean, like in our actual world, it's not until later in the early 1900s and Theodore Roosevelt breaking up trust in the country that you start seeing that some these titans of industry, there was a lot of human costs and a lot of people that suffered under the not only the Vanderbilts but the Rockefellers and the JP Morgans of the world. And so it's pretty on brand for like what it was happening, I think, in this time. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So we'd be remiss of not talking about Peggy and Mr. Fortune and what has happened since their kiss. So they skipped over. We didn't get what we wanted. They skipped over a little buddy cop kind of travel back. They got right back into the city. And Peggy and Mr. Fortune, it's awkward. It's gotten awkward.
I don't know what to say. I'm trying to talk myself down about the feelings that I'm having about the way Peggy has been treated this season.
Yeah.
I love that Peggy is a trailblazing journalist. I really do. And I love that she is taken very seriously as a journalist, both by her parents and by Mr. Fortune. I don't know if Peggy's based on a real character, but she's definitely giving me Ida B. Wells vibes. Mm. However, for Peggy to go from grieving mother to potential mistress, I'm super frustrated with this. Give Peggy a Larry Russell or Dashiell, or like, if you're gonna have a love thing happening, at least make it be suitable. I don't like it. Even Marion is like, girl, have you lost your mind?
Yeah. No, I'm with you on that. It seems weird that they haven't introduced an actual love interest, and because this can't go but so far without like it being bad all the way around. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
so,
I mean, Peggy says, no matter what, I'm going to get hurt. And I'm like, actually, yeah. No, because you could just walk away.
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
You could just be super clear with him. Like, I know she doesn't want to give up her job. I'm not asking her to do that. But I do think there's like, she needs to set a boundary so that this doesn't go any further.
Yeah. I agree. I don't understand why they've taken. I really want her to like get. She's trying to, I think, is what I would say. Is that when he's all like, well, I don't want you to be here alone. She's like, why? Like, I'm like a reporter like everyone else. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I'm good. Like, and I felt like he was kind of like the one pursuing now more than she was trying to move on and say, okay, it happened. Let's leave it in the past. And it just feels like he's kind of like pushing the issue, you know?
I agree.
That line, though, is actually the one you mentioned. Is actually, man, what a good, well-written line. The only thing we both know for certain is that I'm going to end up hurt. I was like, man, this is a bar. Like, who's going to write that? That needs to be a song lyric of some sort. Like, what happened here? That's good. I love it. I absolutely love it. I don't love the fact that she feels that way, but it is giving me, like, serious, like, I should pull a Drake. And
I was like, just going to say, You should do like Drake and just steal from a period like he did with Outlander.
Exactly. Oh my gosh, so good. So good. If you don't know what we're talking about, listen to Pop Star and then go listen to a toast from Outlander. You will be very pleasantly surprised.
I want to live a long life.
I want a long life. What he said. Anyway, you know the whole thing. It's great. Oh man, and another one. Yeah, mm-hmm. It's good. All right, the school dramas. A lot of school conversations. A lot of education conversations happening in this episode.
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing the show is definitely capturing is changing attitudes about educating every class, right?
Yeah.
In the United States, there was never really like there was never a Dickens to be like, look at how the underclasses live, mm-hmm. hold it up to your face, which is, my friends will say, I can't believe she's talking about Dickens because everyone knows I don't like Dickens. But but one thing that Dickens did extremely well was he made poor people a real characters who were not one-dimensional, who left off the page, and the readers, he was writing for mostly a middle-class audience and a wealthy audience. He put shone a light for them on how people lived, on the workhouses, on, you know, what it meant to be, have no money at all, the choices that people had to make, the pain and suffering. And like, while people read his work in the United States, it wasn't, they're reading about something happening somewhere else. I think that this was a time where people were starting to really look at how are we educating our children, and are we able, we talk about this American dream, and that was still kind of like America was not a place where we threw that around, the American dream in politics, the way that we do today. However, that was part of the potential of America, right? Peggy even kind of says that when she talks about this new democracy. And so I think the reason that education looms so large in this season, but particularly in the last two episodes, is because the question of who should be educated and how is coming up. And it's coming, it's eating into the way that people, especially in the North, live, because the North was supposed to be the place where the ideas came from. So I like that they're doing this. The colored schools, which is what they were called, have a long history in New York. Alexander Hamilton was one of the founders, and John Jay, of the first colored school in Manhattan. This storyline is focusing on the colored schools in Brooklyn, which was a different group. But you can still see news articles about these schools, because there's, I think there's only one remaining, like the original structure, and it every so often there's a fight over whether or not like they're allowed to develop near it and all sorts of stuff. But it's a fascinating history about how segregated education in New York City, which was a real melting pot, you know, it wasn't like it was just white versus black. There were also all these groups of immigrants coming in because the city needed the workers, and their kids all were looking to be educated as well. So I really love this storyline. I think it's really cool that they brought this in here.
Yeah. And you're looking at the different classes and how the debate around education for classes, race, culture. So I love what you're talking about, because like you see, like Marion works at a private school, well-staffed, learned about art, learned about music. At the same time, she's volunteering at a school where there's, you know, people who need to learn how to read, right? Then there's
adults,
right? Yeah, exactly. Who've never learned to read or write and need those skills. And then you have Henderson's children who are home in the middle of the day, and the son who's like, doesn't look very old, he probably looks like he should be in high school, is like not going to school, he's working at the factory, right? Like,
yeah, so I would put him between like 15 and 17.
Yeah, so I would too. I totally agree. And then, you know, then you see like everything we just talked about with the colored schools and in Brooklyn, and that they're actually threatening to close them, and the reason they're using to close them is like, you know, ridiculous, right? So it's one of those things where you're starting to see, like, this is what we were talking about the previous episode, is like there's plenty of things to cover around race and the provincial nature of northern segregation, I like to say, like, you know, like it's like there's areas, right, that are even though, you know, there's a melting pot that happens in New York City specifically, there are areas of the city that that especially in this time period where certain immigrants live, like black people live, you know, rich people live. So it's good to see them also addressing how they're educating the different people, segments of society. So speaking of segments of society, let's talk about the downstairs. Let's talk about downstairs. Church and Bannister, peace it out. Dap it up. Bannister almost like messes up Church's whole situation, but then he realizes he's kind of being messed up. So he takes care of it. I love this. I love that the butlers are on good footing. I think this will be put to the test in the future for sure.
I agree, but I'm all for a truce between Church and Bannister, because they're both great. Like, yeah. I love them both. They're both great characters. They both are like caring supervisors, you know, they're not employers, but everyone does report to them. Bannister's a little bit more stuck up, I think, just because he's English. Sure. Like, he just is. But I think they both could be great allies, and I'm just glad this beef is behind them. I think the story about Church's wife is really sad, and I hope we get to learn more about him. This was, in my opinion, when Downton Abbey was its best, was when we got backstory for Mrs. Hughes and Carson, and we didn't really get much for Mrs. Patmore, but I think it was nice to learn more about them, that their whole lives were not just reduced to being servants. So I'm shipping Church and some other lady. I don't, it can't be Mrs. Bruce, but yeah, someone
yeah,
else.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, hope he finds love again.
I do too. And I agree with you that you want more, you know, just like we wanted more from Ada and other people last season, it'd be nice to get a little bit more backstory on Church. You know, I feel like I know Bannister a little bit more. Like you said, like we spent a little bit more time with the Van Ryns downstairs crew, it feels like. But I don't know. I'd like to know more about Church's backstory. It's really cool. I think they're gonna open it up for sure.
I hope so. I hope the show gets another season, because there's a lot of great like potential for storytelling here. So fingers crossed HBO sees this as something that they want to continue, because I'm thoroughly enjoying it.
Please. Yes, I agree. I totally agree. And then, you know, they replace Adel High with the new French lady's maid. Let's hope she's actually French.
That would be hysterical if she wasn't French.
Can you imagine?
I don't think they can go back to that story, but that would...
That would be absolutely great. They should have had Mr. Bourdon, check. He's like, I know you can fake a French accent.
I did think this episode needed some levity, because it was so heavy with the cancer diagnosis that, and with the horrible proposal.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that it was hysterical that they were interviewing that potential ladies' maid who was like clearly just trying to link up with Church.
Yeah, she was pushing up on Church the whole interview process. They were like, no. She said, well, I hope you're the one who calls me.
I mean, I know I just said I hope Church finds love, not this lady.
No. Oh man. And Jack is figuring out the alarm clock, and but you know, trying to work on the patent. And what I love about this storyline, one, is it's setting us up for something, because there is like this, he's the character that since last season has is the voice of something that is different about the other period pieces we have followed. He says he talks about the possibility that one day they could be going to that party, and it is the idea that you could change your station in America in a way that you couldn't in other cultures around the world. And so him being an inventor in this season, to me, keeps opening the door to like him being a person who's in pursuit of more things in his life, love, career. And he does it in such an earnest and wholesome, is the only word I could think of, and just kind way. And the fact that everybody can see that and bands around and gives money to his cause is just so touching. I really love that part of the episode. So.
I just love him. Yeah. He's just such, like you said, he's just so wholesome. I have no doubt that like Jack is exactly who he says he is.
Yeah, agreed.
Like he is just the sweet, he's a good, genuinely good guy. He's hardworking. And he's got a sense of humor. Like I just love him. I just adore him.
Yeah, no, I agree. I totally agree. And you know who else we adore, but don't nearly get to spend enough time with? Gladys Russell. Where is Gladys Russell?
God.
Where the hell is Gladys Russell?
I'm just going to put that in every outline until we get some real Gladys storyline here.
Yeah.
All we get in this episode is her asking her mom if she's actually friends with Mrs. Astor, and then her complaining about being courted.
Yeah, and like I didn't realize it was going to be like this, and also asking, being like, yo, we're going to Montgomery's party. Like, I mean, your mom doesn't even ask, well, what is that party about, what's going on?
Mrs. Russell's really like Whatever, the opera.
Yeah.
I mean, I'll give her a little bit of a break on this one because Larry's going with her. If you can't send your adult son to supervise your daughter, then I don't know. Yeah. Like, then you have a lot of problems.
No, agreed. Agreed.
But I just, she was so, she's like, uh-huh. Yeah, but the Duke is coming.
Oh, man.
I think this is going to come back to bite her. You know, I have a sense that at some point, again, if HBO gives them another season, next season it's going to be like, so when you weren't supervising Gladys, she ran out and fell in love with some very unsuitable person.
Yeah, 100%. No, 100% is going to come back. Something feels weird about this whole, the way that they've set that up. Also, I mean, we talked about dudes sitting on the train forever, but I just want to put a pin in one other thing about that situation that has to do with Mrs. Russell, is once again, George Russell is out here withholding information. He told his wife that it was an accounting error, not that he gave them money and sunk it into the opera. And also, it has to do with freaking Turner again. He's like, Turner and my wife are not to know. Like, why would you do that? Like, why would you do this? Is like lying about the wrong shit again.
Yeah. He lies to her routinely. I like their relationship a lot. I don't like that part of it.
Yeah, 100%. It's just weird. I don't know. The intention, I get it. But again, this is so close to what happened before. It's nuts. Anyway. Do you want to talk about what we Googled? Anything else you want to kind of touch on?
I actually want to acknowledge a email that we got this week.
Oh, cool.
From one of our listeners. I'm not going to read the whole email because I didn't clear it with the listener yet. But one of our listeners wrote in to say that she wanted us to talk more about what's going on with Oscar. So I just want to spend a few minutes because we've talked about Oscar quite a bit, but we haven't really talked about his motivations with this investment and also like what that means when it comes to him and Maude.
Yeah.
So my read of it is, and you tell me if you feel differently, I'm a little bit confused about what Oscar's seeking to do, but my read is that he intends to propose to Maude regardless, because he's doubling down on this investment in this episode, and then he still kisses Maude and he's still courting her, which I don't think is connected to the investment directly. I think that he intends to continue to court Maude no matter what, regardless of whether he becomes a principal investor and gets plenty of money. I guess my concern is, to what end? Like, the investment, I guess the investment makes more sense to me if he's planning on not proposing to Maude, because that means to me that Oscar is attempting to increase his money so that he can be independent and free and he doesn't have to worry about marrying a rich woman. So it feels like a little bit of a disconnect. I do think that
I don't necessarily see it that last way, but you know, finish your thought, but I see one little nuance that could change that if he's going to stay in it.
I do think that he is being Oscar, and this is both dishonest and duplicitous. Like, I don't think that he wants Maude to know. And I don't think that that's for a good reason. I think that Oscar is planning to trick her, right? And I mean that in like the kindest way. Like, Oscar obviously isn't interested in women, but I do think that he has a respect for Maude and had a respect for Gladys. I don't think it's like just Maude. I don't think he'll ever treat them badly, but he's clearly trying to give Maude the sense that this is love, which it is not. And because Maude is independently wealthy, she's not in the situation that Marion is in. She can marry whoever she wants.
Yeah.
So I think there is a level of, he's definitely trying to do something underhand here. That said, I sympathize for him. Like, I feel bad because he doesn't really have any other choice. Like, he is responsible for holding up his family's legacy. He's responsible for making sure that all of the many people who depend on their finances are taken care of. That includes Ada and Marianne. I mean, Ada not so much because she's married now, but mm-hmm. that's a recent development. But that includes Marianne, his mom, Ada, you know, like himself, any children he may have. And so I feel for him because marriage is his only option, just like it would be for Marion. Like, he doesn't really have a lot of other ways to shore up his family legacy. However, he's definitely doing something underhand here. This is not like, I don't know. You should weigh in, say what you were going to say about the investment, but mm-hmm. like, the fact that he hasn't told Maud that he's trying to get in on an investment where she is a principal is real, real underhanded to me.
Yeah, I don't think that that's on the up and up, like, for sure. And I think that she's scoped out his character enough. I mean, that she's questioning it, right? Because she goes to Aurora and's like, hey, like, what's his deal, right? So, and I think that the gentleman who's the money manager kind of like is like feeling uneasy about all of it too, because he's like, hey, why are you not telling her? My take on it is that if her dad is in fact Jay Gould, he's one of the most successful, he's on the same playing field as Mr. Russell. So if we're calling them billionaires, he would be a billionaire and he would have a lot of money. And my take on it is that if he is going to marry someone and do the other piece of this withholding information about like his sexual orientation, that he's not really like that interested in her, if he's going to withhold that information, he wants the life to be comfortable and he doesn't want the life to be comfortable on the bill of her dad, right? I think like he wants her to have a comfortable life because he's not going to be able to give her everything else. I genuinely think he likes her. I don't think it's all like, you know, earnest, like, oh yeah, I just want her to have a comfortable life. But I think there is a part of him that's like, yeah, I'm doing this like because he says she's going to reap the benefits of this as much as me with the life that she has. So there's a motivation there of like, I'm going to have enough money now to not have her have to depend on I'm not going to look like I'm just marrying into money. I'm actually going to have enough money of my own through my own savvy to be able to say that this wasn't just about money when she maybe unraveled some of the other pieces of what is going on.
You make a really good point and something I had not thought about, which is also that if he's a principal investor and let's say that he has to speak to her father to make a case for himself, it will go differently than it did with Mr. Russell.
Yeah. I think so. I think he's trying to position himself where he's not just looking like a person who's like, yes, I have money, but not money that's going to last forever. I'm still having to go out here and work. He wants to get into that generational kind of like money spot, which is why seeing that check is like, oh, this is an opportunity for me to change not only my family's fortunes, but how I have to navigate this betrothal.
Yeah. Okay. That makes total sense. I agree with that, but it's a really tough situation. I'm having a hard time blaming him for how he's pursuing Maud mm-hmm. because as we've noted like dozens of times at this point, when we cover these period pieces, there aren't that many options for everyone's trapped in the system of the type of like gentleman and lady mm-hmm. Scenario. Like it's respectable for him to be a banker, but it's not like he can, you know, go to medical school and become a wealthy doctor and that would be respected in the same way by someone like Agnes, right? Mm-hmm. Like they're not quite like the British aristocracy where any work aside from being a landowner is looked down upon, but you're not supposed to work for money like that, yeah. which is part of the reason that the new money folks are not immediately accepted, because they earned their money. They haven't been rich. Yeah. So I feel for him, but what he's doing from Maud's point of view is horrible. Like,
yeah,
she could potentially marry someone who doesn't love her, will never love her, will use her for, you know, as a beard, basically. And on top of that, you know, have children with her that, and use her for child rearing, basically. I just, yeah. It's not, there's no way to look at this and say Oscar's not doing something wrong. That said, I don't know what else Oscar's supposed to do.
Yeah, I don't know either, but I do know that she brought him in to look at her financial picture and give her advice. And in a lot of ways, he could have left it there, right? Like, you know what I mean? Like, so that is the part that is nefarious on top of the other thing, is that, like, yeah, I get why he's trying to do it. That doesn't make it less problematic. He should talk to her and say, hey, I'm looking at this and I think I want to invest. There would be nothing wrong with that. You know what I mean? Like, if he were to say that, but he's not saying that. He's keeping her in the dark, which is pretty odd. And maybe I'm just like thinking about today's times, but I think, like, I don't know. I think, like, that's where I have the problem, is that he's leaving a lot. He, you know, omission is still dishonesty. You know what I mean? Like,
mm-hmm.
when you're fully aware of, like, what you're doing, it's still a dishonest act. So I think, like, the omission is still a problem, but I understand his motivations. You know what I mean? I understand why he's doing it. I don't think it's less of a problem that he's doing it. I just think that that's probably what his intention is, you know?
What did you think of Aurora's, would you want to be with a man who was never interested in another woman?
I didn't have many thoughts about it. I mean, like,
I didn't think about it until my third watch, which was, I think what she's saying here is that a sure sign of a fortune hunter is somebody who's never shown any interest in settling down. And then here you come, you know, Ms. Moneybags, yeah, and yeah. suddenly he's trying to rush to the altar.
Mm-hmm.
But given what we know about Oscar, and given Bridget, is that her name?
Bridget.
The housemaid in the Van Ryan?
Yes. Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh.
I think her name is Bridget. Given Bridget's comment of last week, I'm wondering, are we supposed to take from this that Aurora knows the nature of her cousin, who she loves dearly, but who she also knows is a fortune hunter, is only trying to marry this woman because she's wealthy?
Yeah, I mean, they've left enough room where they could go that route. I mean, like, in what she says, even when she's like, I think he really likes her, to her husband, and he's like, you mean you hope that he really likes her? It's like there's kind of like there's room there to be interpreted a lot of different ways, which is probably smart for them, because they have to give Aurora something to do every season, right? And she's, you know, her role
is... why is Aurora still on the show?
Resident busybody. She is the busybody. she is the person. If you want somebody who's going to know all the tea and, like, stir the drink, like, she is her. You know what I mean? Like, that is who she is.
You're right. She kind of holds the place of Rosamund on Downton Abbey, their aunt,
yeah.
who, like, was legit just there to, like, stir the pot. Yeah. So often.
I mean, like, who else is going to be at a garden party just sitting there taking an interview and be like, girl, he about to propose to you right now. Like, what? like 2 seconds before the proposal. I'm like, what? Why would you do that?
This information would have been helpful before I left my class.
Yeah, exactly.
Like,
exactly.
You couldn't send me a letter, Aurora. Like, what is going on? Or you couldn't take me aside as soon as I got here. Like, this information would have been helpful before.
Yeah, she let her settle. She let her get some hors d'oeuvres. They dancing at the barbecue. The whole thing is going down. And she's all like, yo, you have no idea what's about to happen. It's crazy. Crazy, crazy. All right. Well, I'm so glad. Thanks for sending in that question. And that's awesome. And please, more of you all, send thoughts and things you want to hear. It's great to, like, have those conversations kind of guided by that. So it's cool. It's awesome. Let's talk about what we Googled. You wanna talk about it a little bit?
So yeah, so upon first watch, I did not take much note of the name of the woman that Dorothy Scott introduces Peggy to. Not introduces, because they obviously knew each other, but reintroduces it. But then when I watched again, I was like, oh, that name is familiar to me. And so what I wanted to do was talk a little bit about Sarah Smith Tompkins, Sarah Smith Tompkins Garnett, who is a well-known education advocate at the time. And her name was known to me because I had done a walking tour some time ago on, this is probably 10 years ago, maybe even longer, on education at the African free schools, which were known as colored schools number 1 through 4 in Brooklyn. So I want to talk a little bit about her this episode. I do just want everyone to know I heavily edited her bio because some of her bio will ruin the rest of this season. Like, it will spoil things that haven't happened on the show yet. It may not even, like, we don't know where this storyline is going to go. So I heavily edited the stuff that was specific to the schools, even though it's history and people could just look it up. But I wouldn't appreciate if someone spoiled the school plot line for me. So I don't want to spoil it for anyone else. As I said, she was a well-known educator. She was also a suffragist and activist, and she played a significant role in the 19th century struggle for civil rights and women's rights. Sarah Smith Tompkins Garnett was born in Brooklyn in 1831 into a free Black family. She grew up with a strong commitment to education and equality and became a teacher at African Free School Number 1 in New York City, where she advocated for quality education for Black children. In 1851, she married Reverend Henry Highland Garnett. Why don't people have three names anymore?
I do.
So do I. But I think it's very rare. Like, these people are so important.
Yeah, exactly. It's very rare. It's rare, you know?
He was also a prominent abolitionist, a minister, and a fellow advocate for civil rights. They were a notable couple in the struggle against slavery, and they used their marriage as a platform for social and political activism. During the Civil War, the Garnetts worked with freedmen and refugees in Washington, D.C. They were involved in the recruitment of Black soldiers for the Union Army and contributed to the relief efforts of those who were affected by the war. After the war, Sarah Garnett continued to work on her commitment to education. She became a principal of the Preparatory High School for Colored Youth in D.C., where she worked to give educational opportunities to Black students. In 1883, after returning to New York, she made history by becoming the first Black female principal in the New York City public school. And that's around the time that we're meeting her. She was also an active participant in the suffrage movement. She was involved in a lot of women's clubs and organization and advocating for women's right to vote. Her involvement in the suffrage movement contributed to the efforts that eventually led to the passage of the 19th Amendment in 1920, which is how women in the United States got the right to vote.
Wow. That's
so like really cool minor character, right? Like,
yeah,
I just love this. This is the type of period piece stuff I want. I want to show the real fabric of the society of the time. Do not make your Black characters, your immigrant characters, invisible. Give them something to do. And what's so cool about this is that they're focusing on real people. This is a real person who really was a principal of one of the all black schools in New York City. Something that people should know. And so before this period, before the 1880s, Black children had to go to these colored schools, but mixed race children were allowed to go to any school. So it was segregated even down to that. Like, if your phenotype made you look black, you went to a colored school. If you happened to be look like you could be mixed race, you were allowed to go into the regular public schools.
Wow.
Wow. And this was, I want to say about 25 years or so before New York passed a law that, like, I won't say it desegregated the schools, because anyone who knows about New York City's education knows that the schools are still segregated to this
exactly,
day.
Exactly.
However, made that segregation illegal.
Yeah. Wow, that's amazing stuff. That's a really, it's something, see, that's what I love about this show is, like, and this is what we talked about when we were talking about covering it, is, like, being from New York, how much we would learn about the place where we live, like, things that we already knew and things that we had no idea about that we're, like, digging into and learning. So it's awesome.
Yeah, no, I've, like we talked about last week, I didn't know anything about the Brooklyn Bridge in terms of who built it. I just assumed a man built it. So that was really cool. As I had said, I heard Sarah Garnett's name before, but I never knew much about her. Mm-hmm. I definitely didn't know much about Mr. Fortune. So I've really appreciated getting to know more about our history. I mean, mm-hmm. I sometimes think about my history education and like world history was 2 years at my high school and American history was one.
Yeah.
And yeah. So, and I know there's a lot less American history, a lot less. But it just sort of shows that even you and I who like love history and mm-hmm. go down these rabbit holes routinely, like we still don't, unless someone puts this stuff in front of us, we're not going to know to Google these things. We're not going to know to look deeper into them.
No, not at all. I agree. Which makes this stuff so cool and so happy that you have been hanging with us. Listen. This is a longer episode, but there was a lot to get to. And thank you for sticking in. If you're at this point, you are a true, true trooper. We appreciate you, all you kinfolk. And keep reaching out to us through email. Loved it. Getting an email to talk to, speak to, and hit us up on KinFolklorePod on all the socials. And we will see you next time.
Bye, everyone.